Up next on Downtown, we are very excited to welcome to the show an acclaimed actor. You know her work in films like The Great White Hope, Kramer versus Kramer, All the President's Men, and Testament, all of which earned her Academy Award nominations. Television performances like Eleanor and Franklin, Playing for Time, and The Good Wife. She's a Tony Award winner for The Great White Hope, an 8-time Tony nominee. Also a former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, a conservationist, and a writer. We're very happy to talk with the multi-talented Jane Alexander. Jane, thank you so much for being with us tonight. You're joining us from Nova Scotia, and I know your family's roots go back, to the mid-1700s when your mother's people settled there?
That's right, Rich, yeah. They came over on one of the first boats from Germany in 1751. They were not mercenary fighters. They were mercenary colonialists. the Brits engaged them to come over.
That must give you a wonderful sense of connection to the land.
It does. I honestly think it's in my DNA. It's remarkable how at home I feel here. And you have to be pretty hardy, even in this day and age, to live on the North Atlantic. It's rough.
Well, absolutely. Certainly during the wintertime and what passes for spring.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I know when you were little, your dad was a surgeon helping victims of World War II over in the UK, and your mother moved the family to Brookline, and you were at the location that had been the headquarters of Frederick Law Olmsted's firm, and that essentially was your playground. How did that shape the person you became?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, because I was thinking about it just recently, because it's coming on the 100th anniversary of Olmsted, and maybe more than 100 years.
200th. His 200th birthday next week.
Wow. Wow. Well, he built this place in Brookline, Massachusetts, on 99 Warren Street for his own personal home. And then he had a room for the landscape draft architects or a building right next door. So growing up, there was a lot of tension for everybody who grew up during World War II, no matter how far you were away. Our mothers were alone. My mom shared the house with another woman and her children. And there was a lot of beauty, though. That's what I loved about the Olmsted estate. You can imagine, he was such a great landscape architect, and he just had a sunken garden with wonderful little plants, and all kinds of little frogs and toads were in there, and beautiful magnolia trees. It was my first introduction to birds and nature. Loved it.
Well, we're coming up on Earth Day here, and as we get to that point, there doesn't seem to be, from my perspective, a real sense of urgency among some of our leaders and certainly some of our citizens to take care of the planet. How do we change that? What can we do, those of us who believe this is the issue of our times?
Well, it certainly remains the issue of our time, but we have a big other issue, of course, with the war, with COVID, with all kinds of other problems that are going on that have been there before. But this is the big one. This climate change one is the major one of our lifetimes and our ongoing children's generation. So it's the one we really have to capture and take control of very, very soon. We all know that. I think it's in us to do that. It's just that we are constantly needing to address these other issues at the same time. I don't think it's going to go away, Chris, Rich. I think it's really going to be right there in us all the time. So I do see changes. I see them incrementally with people, the way they approach food, the way they approach energy systems in their own home. So I think we're making progress.
You have traveled the world to protect animals and wildlife, and I read an interview where you referred to yourself as a self-taught naturalist.
Yes, I was self-taught because I really got into birds after my husband and I moved to the country about 60 miles north of New York City in Putnam County, way back in the early 70s. And I was also working a great deal in many places in the United States and in the world, doing films, theater, and so on. And I wanted a hobby, so I took along some binoculars and a local guide, not a person, because I couldn't really rely on having a person all the time because I didn't know what my shooting schedule was. So I just would take a guidebook and I taught myself a lot. And in some ways, I found it a fine education, because when you have to work very hard yourself to do identification, it sticks in your brain or parts of your brain better, I think, than somebody just pointing out a bird and let's move on.
My father-in-law is a birder, and along with giving you that incredible respect for the animals that are around us, it's also such a wonderful opportunity to find a peace and quiet and solitude of your own.
Absolutely. And I think many, many people during the COVID have discovered that for themselves if they didn't have it already. It's my temple. The world outside my backyard is my temple. And I don't care how big or small your backyard is, there's always lots to find there. I have friends who have peregrine falcons who come in and sit on their window boxes in New York City, you know, 40 floors up. So you can find it anywhere.
We're talking with Jane Alexander here on Downtown. At my full-time job, I'm a high school teacher. I work with young theater students. So I know the importance of teachers. What was it? Was it Mrs. Ramsdell who lit a bit of a fire under you?
Well, Mrs. Ramsdell, good for you, Rich. You really did your homework. She was a wonderful English teacher. She really encouraged me in writing. And then there was another teacher who came in. It was an after-curricular program. And Mrs. Brown, and she was the one who really introduced me to theater after school. And she was the one who, when I was 16, said, took me aside after we had a rehearsal of a play. And she said, Jane, I think that you can make a living at this. Wow. Wow. That was amazing, because my dear Nova Scotia mother didn't know theater or film from anything. And she didn't know what I was going to do in my life to make a living. So my dad was a little more understanding, and he actually encouraged me, because he had wanted to be an actor himself at one point. He turned to medicine, thankfully, but he encouraged me. So I did have one person in the family who, and Mrs. Brown.
Now, I had a Mrs. Brown who was a big encouragement to me. She was a speech teacher. And when I walked into her class, she went through the roll and she saw my name and she said, "Kimball, no, I don't believe you're a Kimball. You're a Gilbert. I shall refer to you as Gilbert from now on."
Oh, my goodness. She took away your name.
Until the day she died, I would run into her. "Oh, Gilbert, how are you, darling?" Was it Long John Silver? Was that the role that that got you started?
Yeah, pretty good. I think I was in either third grade, fourth or fifth. I can't remember when I played Long John Silver, but I had a lot of fun doing it, and a great accent and a great peg leg and a parrot on my shoulder, fake. And I got a lot of laughs. Whoa, loved it.
Now, how did you end up at Arena Stage in Washington? I believe playing Joan of Arc.
That's right. Yes. I made a list when I was 16 about of all the plays that I wanted to do. This is in the classic repertoire. And George Bernard Shaw came up pretty strong on several of them. So St. Joan was on my list to play. And I even auditioned for Otto Preminger for the film, but I didn't get it. Gene Seberg got the role. But when I was in my early 20s, a fellow in New York called me up and said, "Jane, they're doing St. Joan at Arena Stage, and I think you need to audition." So I did, for my future husband, Ed Sheeran, who was the artistic director at the time, and I got the role. And it was my first big role in regional theater. And I loved every minute of playing Shaw's St. Joan.
And of course, it was at Arena Stage that The Great White Hope was originally developed. And some would say irony, I would say perfect symmetry, that that production was made possible because of grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. And of course, later you would become the chair.
That's correct. Yes, there was a $25,000 grant to the playwright of The Great White Hope, Howard Sackler, to develop the play at Arena Stage. And of course, it went on to huge fortune and fame for him, and fame for the theater, but not fortune. It was the first regional theater production to ever transfer to Broadway, but it didn't get a cut of the profits. So it was the first and the last, because every other transfer after that got, of course, recognition and a cut of the profits. So it was very exciting. And when I came to be chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, I remembered that NEA grant to The Great White Hope, which had made my career. And I wanted to give something back. And that's how I came to be chair of the National Endowment for the Arts.
The Great White Hope was such an important play and then successful motion picture as well. Now, here we are 50 years later, and it seems in many ways like our progress on racial issues has not only halted, but has gone in reverse. Is that to be expected? This was never going to be a straight line to getting where we would like to be as a country?
That's a difficult question to answer. I do feel, though, Rich, since I was very active in the civil rights movement, as many people were, although it was more a movement where African Americans wanted to march more on their own, and we were supporting them. Now we're all, at least we're hooking arms together and working for Black Lives Matter, and learning more and more about Black history for ourselves and making sure there's less and less discrimination. So I do think that there is a lot of progress. But my late husband, Ed Sharon, always said, he said, this country was born a racist country. We have to understand that, and we have to work very, very hard, and it's going to take generations and generations to end it. And I like to believe that my grandchildren today are the ones who are going to end it, because I don't see any racist attitudes in them at all.
And yet it's horrifying as an educator to see the attacks on education in this country, and to witness people who believe somehow that the teaching the truth about American history is a bad thing.
I know. Well, that's shocking. But, you know, for every we're in a time of extremes. And we know well, those of us who have lived long lives like myself, that the pendulum will swing and it will start to go the other way. But Martin Luther King said the arc of justice is long, but it will swing back. It's just a really, really difficult time in the world right now. And I think we're going to go through an awful lot of pain and violence, unfortunately.
I want to talk about some of your other film roles. I was rewatching All the President's Men recently. It's such a remarkable film, and you don't have a lot of screen time, but you were so compelling in those moments you have. And that film, to me, holds up very well as a great reminder of a number of things, but most of all, the importance, the value of a free press in a democratic society.
Oh, yes, indeed. A free press. And what does a free press mean? That's the dialogue that we're having now in the world with social media. And I find it really fascinating and a very difficult topic, because, all right, if I want to speak my mind on things, shouldn't we let everybody speak their mind on things and let human nature balance the whole thing itself? Well, it's a hard question to answer. I'm glad we're having the dialogue. But boy, I think we have to have it free.
Kramer versus Kramer, also had a chance to rewatch that again and cried like a baby, as I did the first several times I saw it. Your character of Margaret is so important. I think she grounds the film in a reality and an honesty. And I think one of the things that makes it great is that she and Ted remained friends. There was no hint of a romantic relationship. And that was unusual, I think, for films of that time period. There might have been a tendency to want that to happen. It was so much more effective with you being a support system for each other.
I agree, Rich. I think that it's a beautiful film because of that relationship. There's no hint of any romance ever developing. It's just that they're both gone through a rough time, separation and divorce with kids. And yeah, I love that relationship too. And Dustin and I had a lot of fun.
Testament, I'm not afraid to tell you, scared me to death when I saw it. What a powerful film, what a dark film, and yet one whose message that we've seemed to have ignored in the last 39 years or so.
Yes, and we're coming up right against it right now. The film is about nuclear annihilation in San Francisco, particularly all the missiles dropping there. And my family in the film lives outside of San Francisco. And we continue to live for as long as radiation poisoning doesn't get us, which it gets us in the end. And that's something that we really have to remember, is that it's dropping a major poison on the world. So here we are with the talk of nuclear weapons possibly happening, and it's the most scary thing to my mind. And I was just thinking this morning, I woke up in the middle of the night, actually, and I said, oh my gosh, here's my nightmare come back to haunt me again 50 years later. Because I had a nightmare that, a recurring nightmare that went on for almost 10 years, where three of my kids and myself were coming back from a hiking and camping overnight trip. And we see leaflets pouring from the sky from planes and thousands of people walking north out of New York City. And the leaflets say, do not eat any shellfish, anything that's in the water here, the water is poisoned. And then we tried desperately to get back home to see my husband and our other son. And we're stopped, we're barricaded. The boys sit down by a little pond and we lay down in the trees and they go and collect clams and they start to eat them. Oh. And that's the end of my nightmare. And I used to wake up in a cold sweat. And then I became very active in stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons and all kinds of nuclear things that make radiation. And that was during the 70s. And after I became very active and was giving speeches to stop all kinds and going abroad with groups of other women for nuclear summits and things like that, my nightmare disappeared, and now I feel it coming back again, because we've lost that memory of the horror of it.
Well, and not only that, but in some way, there was a certain level of safety when you had leaders who understood that nobody wins in that situation, and you'd have to be willing to sacrifice your own people. And there are clearly leaders in the world right now who might be okay with that.
Well, exactly. That's what it was called, MAD, mutually assured destruction, that we all understood. If you hit us, we're going to hit you back. But it seems like today they're thinking, oh, well, we got through Chernobyl. We got through the atom bombs. We're going to get through this. No, we are not going to get through this.
We're talking with Jane Alexander here on Downtown. Your career was going very well when President Clinton reached out to you. Was there some reluctance to take on the role as chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, because you knew that would be incredibly time consuming?
Oh, well, I knew it would be time consuming, but it also was a great honor, Rich. It really was. The NEA was under an awful lot of onslaught from mainly conservatives in Congress, who wanted to end it because of a couple of grants they felt were egregious, mainly the homoerotic photographs of...
Was that Mapplethorpe? Robert Mapplethorpe?
Yeah. That's right, Robert Mapplethorpe. And Serrano's beautiful photograph called, he named it Piss Christ. Right. It's actually a photograph of a crucifix in beer bubbles, but piss made it seem like it was in urine. But in any case, these were about to bring the whole agency down, these grants, which were not directly to the artists, by the way, but they were part of a museum or gallery, museum retrospective. And anyway, I came in at a rough time, but as I say, I really love the agency because it really made the arts possible all across the United States of America. It came in as an agency under Lyndon Johnson in 1965, and it just had seeded the arts everywhere, which was very exciting to me. And I wanted to give back because of the grant to the Great White Hope in Arena Stage. It was a very, very difficult 4 years. We were really up when Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress, the first Republican total Congress in 40 years came in 1995, it looked like the agency was going to go under. But you know what? The American people were great. I traveled to all 50 states. I saw and met with people everywhere and tried to explain what the NEA did, that most of the grants that we gave were matched by the community. And that's how the arts proliferated. And I said, so that little dance studio that you take your child after school is an NEA grantee. And don't you want to keep that? Yes, yes. People began to understand what the NEA did. And it was as positive and as nonpartisan an organization that you could possibly get. And so they were the ones that let their people in Congress know to keep the NEA alive. We won by one vote in the end.
Well, and the culture wars, which continue today, they succeed at whatever level they do by putting things in the abstract. But when you get to people's community and say, this is what the arts actually are. They are that dance group. They are that community theater organization. And people always want to support that because they know it's the lifeblood of any community. But in the big picture, whether it's an art exhibition or whether it's the monolith of Disney today, easier to paint that as a bad guy in the abstract.
Absolutely. Or that artists, all we have to do is look at the stars on the screen. The artists don't need help. Oh, no, they don't need help. They all make lots of money. Well, that's like 0.1% of the people are the big stars. They may take a lot of money off the top, but the average artist is not a wealthy person by any matter of means. They hardly make it.
I've enjoyed a great deal of your recent work. You were great in Modern Love, which was a wonderful series.
Thank you. Thank you.
You were back on Broadway on Grand Horizons, another Tony nomination for that. Are there returns to go back to Broadway at some point?
I don't know if I'll go back to Broadway because, first of all, that play just was wonderful and drew me in so much playing this wonderful woman who Nancy, who just lived with her husband for 50, 60 years, long, long marriage. Well, it was the 50th wedding anniversary when the play starts. And she says, I think I'd like a divorce. And I was like, oh boy, okay, there's a story here. Let's get to that. And that's what the whole thing was, that she really had never had a life of her own. It had all been based on her husband, what he wanted and everything. So it was a funny, charming play, and it drew me in. But you know, Rich, I'm in my 80s now, and it takes an awful lot of stamina to do a show on Broadway eight times a week. And I found I couldn't do anything else. The truth is, it cut into my birding time. So I don't think I'm going to do another play on Broadway. I've had a wonderful career. I've done, you know, dozens of plays in New York, regional theater all around the world. And I'm grateful for every bit, but I don't have to do it anymore.
I did see an interview where you said, perhaps tongue in cheek, that your goal was to become the oldest ever Oscar winner.
Yes. Well, I saw that Tony Hopkins 2 years ago, won for The Father at the age of 83. And Tony and I and Marsha Mason were in a wonderful production of Old Times, Harold Pinter's Old Times, at the Roundabout Theater in New York way, way back in the 70s. And we got to know each other, and I have such admiration for both Marsha and Tony. And I thought, well, if Tony can do it at 83, I think I can best him and get an oldest actress, actor, male or female, ever in the future, because I'm already almost 83. So there we go.
Well, in whatever work you do, whether it's stage or film or television, it seems to me that your characters are always imbued with an honesty, but also with a dignity. Does that come from having respect for whoever you're playing, whoever's life you're going to make your own for that moment?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know, but thank you for the compliment. I have played some pretty heinous characters, too, in my life, you know, people who won't take responsibility for murder or mayhem of any sort. But I think one always has, when you're playing any character, you have to understand it from their point of view. And so I find the murderer in me.
Well, again, you have to understand what made them do whatever it is they did.
That's right. That's right. And they have their reasons.
Well, Jane, it's been an absolute delight to talk with you. I've been a fan of and appreciated your work for many, many years, not only your work as an actor, but everything you do for the arts and for the environment, for wildlife. You're a great role model to a whole lot of people.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. I just want to say one last thing, because I work with a fellow in Maine who is a fabulous birder ornithologist, Jeff Wells, and he works for Audubon. And what we're doing now is protection of the boreal forests of the northern United States and Canada. Maine is, you know, one of our great ones.
Jane, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.